So maybe we should start. So, time is so okay. This is going to be like an informal discussion slash talk on black holes. I will start by saying something, and to then at some point J. Armas will continue, and I will sort of say during my outline where. What aspects of black holes he will discuss. So we heard a very nice talk by Mukund last week on fluid gravity, and he started and ended a little bit by saying, writing this diagram that this connection between fluid mechanics, hydrodynamics, and black objects has sort of three regimes: a membrane paradigm regime, an ADS fluid gravity regime, and in some sense a more general regime called the black hole regime. So this discussion is about telling you a little bit about what this is. Also, maybe a little bit, it's always interesting. So, the original motivations that led to the discovery of that development, say, and what sort of the general principles are. I don't think, in my discussion, I don't think I will say a lot about how to go from here to here. Actually, since this discussion, maybe after J has also said something, Mukund can say something about it, because he told me he's precisely looking at this. Let's say I have of course, we have a rough picture of what it means to go from here to here. Of course, that's in a sense that's doing the black hole approach in a more general setting for D3 brains to start with. So I just first want to focus more generally what's this black hole approach. So actually, for historical reasons, actually interesting, I think, to remark that this black hole approach really originated from a KATP program 6 years ago that Don and Rob Myers and Louise Lehner organized. Was called Scanning New Horizons, General Relativity Beyond Four Dimensions. Subset of the participants here was a sizable subset was also there. And it's really fair to say that, well, of course you cannot predict the past or the future, but I think it's fair to say that if it weren't had been for that KITP program, this talk on black holes wouldn't take place, because it was a true sort of synergy, to speak in the administrator's parlance, between people coming. So notably, Roberto was here, Troels Harmark was here, Roberto Amperon, Troels Harmark, and I was here. And we involved many of our collaborators, but we started discussing these things. And actually, well, as it's often the case, our original thing was kind of narrow. At that time, we were thinking very much about, well, the richness of the landscape, not that that's narrow, but the richness of the landscape of stationary black holes in higher dimensional gravity. It was by that time, it was 2006, say 5 years ago, 5 years later, past the discovery of the famous black ring solution in five dimensions, exact new solution of vacuum Einstein gravity, with a new that showed a black object with a new horizon topology of S2 cross S1, which was surprising, I think, to a large part of the community. And which sort of, which also showed that the whole notion of black hole uniqueness that one was used to from four dimensions suddenly disappeared in five and higher dimensions. Of course, a posteriori could have suspected this, in the sense that Einstein equations are, even though their form is rather the same, just if you write it like r mu equal zero in any dimension, the actual possibilities as a set of differential equations seems to grow, and the five-dimensional black ring was an example of that. So just to come back to what I was saying, our sort of narrow focus was, can we make higher dimensional black rings? And our original thought of that was that okay, if you have a black string, can we bend it into a black ring? That was the original question. Just from the five-dimensional solution, it was actually already known that if you had the five-dimensional black ring, so the horizon topology, so this is an S1, and along the ring you would have an S2, so the horizon topology is a product of that. It was already known just from the exact metric that if you zoomed in locally on this black ring, the metric actually really looked like a black string. Not just a black string, but a boosted black string. Basically because the black ring, the regular black ring, was known to be rotating, say, the singly spinning one in this S1 direction, essentially to balance the forces. So that's sort of how it started. And so if we take a step back now, what so this originated the Blackfold approach. Wait, I actually think I wanted first to use my iPhone, but then I discovered that my eyes are not good enough. I was so impressed by your iPhone talk. Then I thought I'll do the iPad. I'll go back. But since the screen disappears all the time, I will take the normal paper.
Yeah, you're all the way back.
So, Bukun really set the new standard in talk giving from the iPhone. Like, you can give anybody talk in the airport on your way to the conference. So, just take a step back again and say what the black hole, how it was motivated. So the dynamics of black holes in greater than five dimensions. Well, so five dimensions is really a sort of a crossover case in the sense that in five dimensions, if you assume two commuting axial isometries beyond your time-like killing isometry, so if you have three isometries in five dimensions, vacuum Einstein gravity in five dimensions can be reduced to an integrable system, and that has, and I'm sure you have heard many talks about it, that has really led to the discovery of large, probably all the possible exact solutions with those symmetries in five dimensions. But that's a four-dimensional tool that you're using here, a tool that has been very successful in four dimensions, namely use the symmetries of the problem and make a consistent ansatz and then find the integrable system. You can just show that this is not the case anymore. You don't have enough killing isometries in higher dimensions. So the dynamics of black holes in greater than five dimensions suddenly makes sort of a jump in complexity. That's also why we took the point of view. So maybe we shouldn't demand ourselves to find all the solutions exact, but get a feeling of what are the possible black holes and what are their horizon topologies by approximate but analytic construction, where we try to form new black objects by bending, for instance, black strings into rings, or more generally, black brains into black objects, say two brains on balls or three brains on three spheres, etc., etc. But in the process, we also discovered that this way of looking at, say, the deformations of black brains, because what we're deforming a black brain, not only can give that insight into new stationary black holes, but it actually also can give us insight really into the dynamics of black holes. These deformations don't necessarily have to leave the black brains stationary. You can just look at long wavelength perturbations for any brain. So what do we mean with that more precisely? Let me write down the metric of a black brain. Like P brain. I write it sort of in a covariant way. I write it for a boosted. This will be an important starting point of the construction. A boosted black P brain. In these are our conventions. In D equals M plus P plus 3 dimensions. N is a useful variable because it appears here. Dt squared plus that would be the general metric of a flat boosted black P brain, So sigma are the walled volume coordinates, and this is your local boost, constant boost. Obviously, that's the solution of vacuum Einstein gravity. So the brain has a characteristic scale, we call it the thickness, the horizon radius scale R0. So when we talk about perturbing it with long wavelength perturbations, we mean that the perturbations are much bigger than this intrinsic scale of the brain. And it's in that regime that we seek an effective description of the dynamics of the brains. So what the black fold construction is then is a, and I will give you some of the meat. Effective walled volume theory for long wavelength dynamics of black brains. Now, for the sake of exposition, I will tell a little bit in the end, if there's time, about charged brains, but just for simplicity, I will consider neutral black brains. Of course, so the generalization to charged black brains is obviously very interesting. It's not just a generalization for the sake of generalization, but there we get into the realm of bending D brains of string theory, or bending fundamental strings, or NS5 brains in string theory. And there are actually very interesting connections, I think, to the DBI action. In a sense, it's an approach that goes beyond the DBI action by including thermal effects on the supersymmetric or extremal D brains, or strings that we know and use a lot in string theory. But just for the sake of the formal development, it's good to focus first on the neutral black brains. And this effective description involves, and I will, of course, get to some equations where I show it, but it involves fluid-like descriptions of the type, really, that we're quite familiar already from ADS fluid gravity. But it also involves, say, solid-type properties that have to do with, and it's quite, once you see the equations, easy to imagine, and also kind of clear why you don't see it in the ADS fluid gravity as it has been done. So the fluid has to do with the intrinsic perturbations on the brain. Let's say variations in the thickness as you move around on the walled volume, or variations of the boosts, the local boosts. That's precisely also what you do in ADS fluid gravity. You start to perturb now not a flat brain, but an ADS black brain. But the solid type properties have precisely to do with the extrinsic dynamics of the brain, namely the embedding of this brain in the ambient background space-time. Which I didn't write here yet, but that will be the next step. So far we have, this was a flat brain, but we can embed this brain in a way, and then see for this configuration to be in equilibrium what the equations of motions are that will determine this embedding. So, but I hope it's also clear that this will be an effective description that's valid in a regime where you have two or more widely separated scales. It teaches us many things, but just to highlight some properties. So we believe you can infer properties of the space of black holes by extrapolation. Of course, I mean, that's partly conjectural, but in some cases this has been validated. But so you can get some actual analytic information in the regime of these widely separated scales, and from that extrapolate, make reasonable assumptions, and start to make predictions about black holes, say, in the perturbative regime. It reveals these fluid and solid properties. So I should also say here, for the more numerically oriented people, it actually provides truly sort of benchmarks for the numerics, because you have some analytic results in some region. And I know some people that have used it for that effect. But so it gives us a new way to look at instabilities of black objects, and that's where Jay will focus on in his exposé mostly. In the sense that, say, the Gregory-Laplanche instability, for example, can really be understood, the long wavelength limit of it, as a fluid instability. You can say more things. Jay will do that. Really, also when you do charged brains, just from a fluid perspective, it really gives us new types of fluids that fluid people never thought of. And in particular, also when you consider intersecting brains, so brain configurations with various charges, for example, an F1BP system, that in the fluid language, that will correspond to a certain anisotropic fluid carrying multiple charges that have not been considered in the fluid literature, and for which we actually have some reason to examine the dynamics. And I should, like to advertise here just that when applied to deep brains, like I said, or for that matter to fundamental strings, in the particular context of string theory, of course you can do this to start with in any dimension, but you can look at the brains that you like a lot in string theory, then it gives us a description of thermal range strings that go beyond, in the case of D-brains, DBI, in the case of fundamental strings, Nambu-Goto. In the sense that, well, so hopefully at the end I have some more time to say it, but just to say in words, I mean, these are extended objects. So obviously when, we also know this, but when you heat them up, their internal degrees get excited. And while many computations, say, in string theory, one probes, say, a finite temperature space, a black hole, with a deep brain or a fundamental string. But the way people do it, and that's also certainly correct to a leaning order approximation, is even though your background has a finite temperature, you probe it with the super cold, say, the extremal brain, and then you consider, say, the action of this, the probe equations of motions of these extremal objects in the black hole or finite temperature background. But so this Blackfold method actually points to that you can now do something that is, we believe, more accurate, in the sense that you can, through this formalism, take the probes to be at thermal equilibrium with the background that you put them in. And you can really see it at the level of the equations of motions, in the sense that when we get to it, the equations of motion we got are sort of, well, not sort of, they are a natural generalization of the DBI equations of motions. But now accounting that we have a stress tensor, that we have an object that has a thermal population of modes on it. Okay, so that's a sort of first introduction. Now let's get to some equations. But let me, so these are all the people, and there are more, but the, certainly the, what I'm talking about that this work is based on. Just for the and it's also important to emphasize that you have something like this, an effective description for black objects, is very much tied to the fact that in higher dimensions you don't have just black holes but black brains. I mean that's a crucial ingredient. Because obviously, like a black hole, like in four dimensions, you know that there's only one intrinsic scale associated to the horizon, like even like a rotating Kerr black hole. Maybe there's some angular momentum and some size, but because of the Kerr bounds, the Kerr black hole is always approximately round. And this whole idea that you have a separation of scales came from just looking when I say black hole I often mean more generally black objects, but separation of scales on black hole horizons, you can really see it, like I said, in the ring. So if you have, if you go to the ultra spinning limit, it starts to look locally more and more like a black string. So that's a concrete example. We can test it in 5D. And for Myers-Berry black holes in D greater than or equal to 6, in 5 dimensions they cannot be ultra spinning, but you also have you can consider these ultra spinning limits where it really starts to look like a pancake. And the thickness of the pancake is much smaller than the extension of the pancake. So it starts to look like locally like a membrane in the plane of rotation. So these two explicit cases really give us a hint that certain stationary black holes in a, in a regime of widely separated scales can be understood locally as just boosted black brains, strings from membranes, etc.
You made the comment earlier that you might hope to map out the entire space of black objects. Would you, I mean, granted that this is an excellent crutch to build up the probability using this?
No, okay. So, no, I really don't, then I gave the wrong impression. I certainly don't want to claim, and we, that all black holes, all phases of black holes will have such a regime. There can be phases that end in the phase diagram at the point where you don't have widely separated scales. I was reminded a little bit, but you gave a talk in Paris where you found this. Was it you? Where you found circles, you had some solitonic solutions with an ADS circles in parameter space. That you know could also happen here in principle. Right? That's one. So, by the way, maybe I'm not so clear, but typically, okay, one nice way to draw phases is, say, if you have one angular momentum for fixed mass area or entropy versus J. So maybe I should make it a little bit concrete because I'm maybe assuming too much. But so, for example, in D equals 6, what are we talking about? This is the Myers-Berry black hole. Can have this ultra-spinning limit. And then, okay, we know by the construction that we have very large black rings. Well, I didn't tell you yet how we do it, but they're there. And then, okay, a conjectured extrapolation of the five-phase diagram is like so. So, and here there's some, so So these are lumpy black holes. These are spherical black holes, and these are black rings. So, indeed, we're not claiming that any phase extends for J going to infinity. I mean, we can take, for example, already this. Well, I don't know if you. This dimpled phase is very non-perturbative. It emerges here from a stationary like Gregorian Plumb threshold mode of the myasteric brain and ends here in some topology, a change in transition where it gets pinched through and becomes a black hole. But so, certainly don't want to. But let's say, okay, and that's of course not very qualified, but we believe that large classes of black holes can be described like this. Or you can.
Your conjecture would be that the classes which have a continuation to separation of scales are described by this, but the ones that don't have continuation to separation of scales might not be.
Right.
Certainly, it's clear from the formalism that the formalism applies to the separation of scales.
Yeah. Exactly.
I might hope that there's something special about black objects that sort of transcends that you might generalize things to.
Something else, yeah, okay. I mean, we certainly don't know of anything violating this.
When you have a separation of scales, what happens in the Hawking temperature, or what determines the Hawking temperature?
Okay, so these brains have a local temperature. I'm going to get to that, but so these brains have a local temperature. It's called script T, N over R0. Now, if you want to make a stationary solution, so let's take a string. If you want to make a stationary solution of this, then okay, one of the conditions is that it should have a uniform Hawking temperature all over the horizon. So, look, to answer your question, for stationary solutions, this Hawking temperature is constant. You have a constant surface gravity over the whole bent object. That's part of the conditions, otherwise you wouldn't call it a stationary solution. If you really look at perturbed solutions, so non-stationary perturbation, it will vary a little bit. There will be local, that's like in fluid dynamics, because of this fluid dynamics, there will be local thermodynamic equilibrium, but not global. I will write down some equations, hopefully soon. Okay. Without writing any equations, but just to say it in words, the spirit of bending this thing into, bending the straight thing into some, perturbing it into some flappy membrane, and finding an effective description for that is, that's not rocket science. It's very much like how it's done in many other descriptions that you know of, like for example, the Nambu-Goto effective description of Nielsen-Olesen vortices, or for that matter, like the DBI description of D-brains, which is also valid only in the regime where the fields vary on long scales over the brain. So what we're after is a theory that integrates out some short distance near horizon degrees of freedom, and write that down, that effective theory. The crucial difference, of course, I should emphasize with the two cases that I just said, is that in this Nambu-Goto description, or DBI of the Nielsen-Olesen vortices, or the DBI, there's no thermodynamics, right? But these are, we have here black objects, we have intrinsically thermodynamics associated with.
When the DBI action has infinite number of derivatives, so I didn't think of it as just valid in some long wavelength approximation. I mean, what would be the cutoff? When does it stop being valid? At what scale?
Let's see. In the DBI case, well, maybe I'm. Oh, sorry. But okay, the DBI case, like the nonlinear action with the square root, it neglects derivatives of the field strength, right? So
I see what you're saying.
It's in that. So it's, okay, the cutoff is R over LS, where R is the scale on which the field strength.
There's a qualitative difference, though. I mean, so for the Nambu-Goto case of Nizam, also in this story, Joe and Henry many years ago tried to design the Nambu-Goto from just broken, so they're both from mode. So you have a skin and a brain.
Right.
And they could put it in ambient space. The Goldstone modes correspond to broken translation invariants. And you can ask what is the effective field theory of these Goldstone modes. So you break translation invariants in transverse directions. And you can ask, well, what is the effective theory of these Goldstone modes? And you can use various symmetries to constrain the effective action of the Goldstone mode. And the leading piece you will get, if you assume some kind of full Lorentz invariants, is DBI or Nambu-Goto for this field. And then if you try training this guy, then you will see the derivative corrections. And for, if I remember correctly now, I don't think anybody has done this for DBI, for D-brains, but for string, certainly, or for Aronian.
Yeah, Aronian company, I've looked at this, correct.
How to do this.
Oh, but.
4 orders or 6 orders in derivatives.
That's right, but so why do we say that's different? Like, I'm. The action, I will at some point write down action. That will be the leading order action, and it will also get, you know, infinite derivatives of the.
But I think this is also something that Don was asking last week, but I think that the dynamics of these Goldstone modes, which are part of the extrinsic dynamics,
right,
to me sounds slightly qualitatively different from the dynamics of the intrinsic modes. And in the vacuum, which is when you're talking about extremal equivalence of number of both the strings, you don't have the intrinsic dynamics.
Certainly. So this actually, well, Jay will say more about it, but I mean, I think what you're saying is very much like the intrinsic dynamics is fluid dynamics, the extrinsic is elasticity more. And whenever actually we write down actions, it's for stationary solutions where we assume that the fluid equations are solved, and we're only left, so we're on shelf for the fluid equations, and we you can try to find a more general action that incorporates both the intrinsic and the extrinsic dynamics. We actually looked a little bit just how fluid people did that. It looks very ugly because it's all kinds of constraining actions. Maybe it's still interesting to examine, but that line has not been pursued here yet. Now let's get some equations. So we have a flat black brain, let's say neutral, the one I just gave you. To that, that brain, that geometry, in fact, is sourced by an effective energy momentum tensor that you can compute in the asymptotic regime of the flat brain. Okay, it's a standard calculation for any brain
to compute that energy momentum tensor.
You will get,
for a flat brain,
obviously a perfect fluid. Well, I hope it's obvious, but for a flat boosted brain, a perfect fluid tensor. And so, what the geometry, the actual solution for Einstein equations corresponding to this flat brain tells you is the specific equation of state of the fluid that corresponds to the brain. So, for example, for a neutral brain, in units, in appropriate units, you find in terms of the, you know, there's always one parameter here, R0. In terms of the thickness, that the energy density is like this and the pressure is like that. And it has a local temperature like so, and a local entropy density. I'm doing this all up to factors. And those satisfy local first law, and there is also a Gibbs-Duhem relation that relates these things. So that's for a piece of flat brain sourced by such an energy momentum tensor. So what we now and just, you can imagine that if you now do this for a charged brain, you'll find again, some energy momentum tensors like that. The only thing is that there's an extra parameter, the charge parameter now. So that what it will do, it will affect your equation of state. And in addition, you have now an extra quantity, namely a current living on your brain. But I think I can already see, given the time, it's sort of outside the scope to give you the details of that. You can ask about it. So now we consider letting this brain fluctuate a little bit, but still where we can patch it up in some sense as pieces of locally flat brains, which is okay in the regime where your fluctuations are on a much larger scale. And what that really means is that you start to make, say, the thickness of the brain dependent on the position of where you are.
Did you make the
fluid, the local boost dependent on the brain? This you're very familiar with ADS fluid gravity. And also the embedding of the brain in the ambient space-time, I denoted by X perp. You can covariantize it in the sense that I'll use X mu or sigma, but the longitudinal directions are pure gauge. But it's a nicer gauge invariant way to covariant way to phrase it like this. And these are, okay, I just wrote it down here, but these are really our collective modes describing the brain. So we have identified what the collective modes are, and we want to find the equations of motions that determine these. So what that really also, okay, now I don't want to, so what it means is that I should write down one thing. So let's be very explicit what we're really doing vis-a-vis Einstein equations. We're now perturbing this, letting this depend on sigma. We have now an induced metric instead of a flat metric on the brain. You do this in a given background. In my talk, I will mostly think that the background is asymptotically flat space. It can be ADS space, it can be an other black hole, the Sinner space, it can be anything you want, principle. So this is the induced metric on the brain. We make this now dependent of where you are on the brain. It's a little bit more common. R0 sigma over R to the N. This is the last metric I will write down. And obviously, this is now not the solution of Einstein equations anymore. And you have to start correcting the metric to next order in a derivative expansion to make this a solution. Now, you can first of all ask, the leading order question is, what are the equations of motions of these? There's a whole story. I will derive these equations of motions using symmetry principles. That's how we originally did it. I could also turn history around and do it using a proof that Roberto Emperon and Kamps found recently in December, I think, using Einstein equations. It's a long story because for a subset of brains, it was derived earlier using the Einstein equations. But then we had a more general symmetry argument for all brains, but now everything is derived up initio. But without going into all these details, probably it... it will not surprise you that the equation of motion boiled down to covariant conservation of the energy momentum tensor. I mean, we postulated that, and I just say it again, it has now really been proven for all cases that it's correct. We postulated, checked it for some cases. But this is what you need for consistent coupling of some energy momentum tensor to gravity, so it's not...
What Where the stress tensor is always given by your formula there, where epsilon and p now varying.
Right, exactly. And you can see here, well, in this case, these are the collective modes. The counting also works out, obviously. They are the collective modes, 1 plus p plus the transfers. So in total, you have the collective modes. You have the equations. And the whole point is, of course, that this separates into indices parallel to the brain and into equation where the indices are perpendicular to the brain. And so these are nothing but the intrinsic fluid equations. And so these are the fluid side of the story. And this is the solid side of the story. This is the, say, the extrinsic curvature of the second fundamental tensor objective with the energy momentum tensor. It's in fact, it's kind of, well, it is the brain generalization of the geodesic equation of Newton's law. Carter found this equation, although he never really applied it to black brains, but he set himself this very interesting problem. What are the equations of motions for extended objects? And when you get done, it's sort of, you could have guessed it without doing any math. Because it, actually this you can write, just want to write down this, so that you could really have guessed. There are many ways of writing this, but if you want to write it sort of in the way you teach your students the geodesic equation for a particle, it's just this. So you can see when you have a zero-dimensional object, a particle, then this just runs over time, and this becomes the mass, and you just have the geodesic equation. So that's what this equation tells. And
yes. Sorry, one question. If you thought of the object as composed of sort of point bits, and figured in what the force is coming from the...
You mean really like...
Yeah, and did the sort of generalized geodesic equation with the accounting for the forces of those point bits, would that end up being equivalent or not?
That's a good question. Yeah, well, from the form, okay, I would guess so, but I have never really, I don't know what, you have to really define, I mean, when you say that, do you already have a well-defined way in, that you would could separate the brain into point bits, or is it? Yeah, right, no, indeed. So, well, have you ever thought about it?
Sense if those patches are averaged out over a number of points where you can define the density. I don't know if it makes sense to consider it.
Because, yeah, indeed, like, you know, this is really an extended energy momentum tensor. I mean, so if you really go to the point limit, then it would just be points having mass, right? And there's no pressure, say, in your system. I find it hard to see you could get it from a point like...
No, so it wouldn't be, you know, a dust sheet or something, because you still have the stress energy to the system as pressure.
Points connected by springs.
So indeed, dust sheet wouldn't do the job, but points connected by springs, well, yeah. Say it like that, I think there should be a way to do it, yeah.
So I'd seen that equation that Carter derived, you know, before, and talks by Carter and by Don Roberto, but I haven't until recently heard it referred to as the solid, you know, acting like a solid. So I mean, is it easy to see that this is the equation?
Well,
the solid
so Jay, you will say more about that, right? So I would refer that to Jay, then he also has, I mean, that's part of his thing. So, I shouldn't say it, because you're also going to discuss elastic speeds and stuff like that, that you can get. Okay. So, not to deflect the question, but otherwise I take... Okay. I think I should... Yeah. Then. So, I will not even draw... So, I just will say some words now and one more equation, and then I stop. So... But of course, there's much more to say, but you can ask. But so these are what we call the zeroth order Blackfold equations. That is, if you want to bend a brain and keep the horizon regular, the claim is to leading order, you have to solve these equations. And it has been now actually proven by Einstein equations. And again, we did it for cases. So it's zeroth order. So. I just want to read, so, but that point is important with Einstein equations. So if you wouldn't know them or wouldn't know this guess, and you would just do the perturbation like I did here, you would actually find these equations as regularity constraints on this perturbed solution. So these equations really ensure regularity at the next order. Of course, to ensure regularity at the second order, so this would be first order in derivatives. To now have regularity in the second order, the corrections equations will of course be corrected, and Jay will actually say something about that. At the level of stationary solutions, so I just say now something more about how can we learn something about new stationary solutions. So that's my last 5 minutes. So stationary black holes. You solve, so the recipe is, so for stationarity you want to solve that, so I have a stationary fluid. That's not so hard because you can align the fluid velocity with the killing vector of your background, and then we actually typically, well, we assume that this killing vector extends to the whole space-time. So we solve star. That gives you something like, for example, just to give you an expression, in terms of some velocity on the brain that R0 is given with an expression like so. Well, I'm skipping details and I also should skip details, but the bottom line is you can solve star. Now, really reduce it to solving this equation for the embedding coordinates, and then you can, that tells you how to wrap brains on compact manifolds, how to wrap black brains so as to get new black objects. So for example, you can take a P brain and wrap it on an SP, and you can only do this when this is odd, in the sense that you can only satisfy these equilibrium conditions when it's an odd brain wrapping an odd sphere. That has to do with the fact that even spheres have fixed points of the rotation group, so you cannot satisfy these equations. So you just find, for this is just a large class of new black holes that have the topology of S odd cross S n plus 1, because every brain also has a transverse n plus 1 sphere attached to it. This is then a large family, for example, that generalizes black rings. And I can give you a whole list of other things. Yeah, they will always be rotating, just like the rings. So, you can see that.
I just wanted a static horizon. You just put the Einstein metric on the product into the
substrate. You want a static horizon, but then this equation becomes k rho equals 0, so the equation for minimal surface, but you cannot get compact horizons like that, but you can get hyperbolic static horizons like that.
Yes. So, I mean, the solution we know best, the curve, doesn't fall into this class because it's, you know, dropping a two-sphere in some sense. So, do you expect in higher dimensions there would be even-dimensional spheres cross, say, Sn plus 1, but they just wouldn't be in this regime where you have a separation of scale.
But the pancaking monastery ones.
I'm happy you asked, because then I can tell you that so my theory fits beautifully, because you can wrap pea brains. The slogan is, you can pea brains on odd spheres,
yeah,
or even balls. So if you do it on odd spheres, you get this, sort of the generalization of black rings. If you do it on even balls, simplest example being, say, a disk, that describes the ultra-spinning regime of Myers-Perry black holes. And the way it works out is actually very beautiful. I just really emphasize at the technical level, for us that was a very important check, that we could connect to that with all and get and reproduce the thermodynamics and the properties of Myers-Perry black holes, because it's kind of unknown territory. But you actually, how does it work really? For Myers-Perry black hole. So these ones have actually constant R0 over the whole sphere. But Myers-Perry black holes are a case where R0 varies over the brain. It's just like this formula, in fact. So you have here a vibration of the transfer sphere that vanishes at the edge of the ball or of the disk. Precisely, actually, because the fluid living on the brain reaches the speed of light at the edges. So Myers-Perry black hole satisfied this in a very beautiful way, that the horizon pinches off because the fluid reaches the speed of light. And then you can do it for any.
I guess my question was, these are the solutions you can reach using black holes.
Right.
But do you believe, or it seems plausible, there's another class of solutions of the sort Brodeco is suggesting that are not related to these solutions at all, that would be more like Kerr, that would have extreme bounds, that would have topology S to the, you know, an even power cross maybe S to an even power or something.
Sorry. This topology, basically, I mean, in this case, we have an Sn plus 1, let me use this symbol, non-trivially fibered over a P ball, like this. So I call this the P ball here, like this. And that is an S E plus N plus 1, in fact. So we do get a spherical, if I understand, maybe we do get a spherical.
The product of two even spheres. Black holes whose horizon is the product of two even spheres.
Sorry, even sphere.
S2 plus S2.
Okay. Sorry. I'm sorry. I misunderstood your question. Okay.
That's so that's something I think that's known how to do with using black holes, but one might suspect that they still exist, but they'd be more Kerr-like, and that you don't.
Sorry, I misunderstood your question.
Yeah, asymptotic.
Okay. That's a very good example of ones where we can just already see, we cannot reach there, and they might well exist.
Might exist. I wouldn't see it.
Sorry, you meant really like that.
People who classify near horizon, so let's keep on the near horizon geometry, they do find that S2 plus S2 is a possible near horizon geometry.
In fact, right. Can even be, don't even have arbitrary Riemann surfaces you could have.
Connected
some Tori. That's a very good example that, well, we have no reason really to believe that they don't exist. Okay, so the last equation I just want to write down to ponder. Well, I don't know. It's always nice to have an action. So in this stationary case, so if you solve this, plug the solution in here with some machinery, you can actually write an action that's quite beautiful, because it's very simple, and you could have almost guessed it. It's just the integral with the induced metric determinant of the pressure. Varying that action gives these equations of motions. And you know, of course, many examples of that, right? Nambu-Goto That's a case where the pressure is constant, and it just gives minimal surfaces. D-brains, well,
of course, there's a little story that,
so D-brains without background fields would be cases where you have a uniform pressure. And you can also include the background fields, but and still have it described by this, but it's a little long story. And
so this is going to end the world body.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
And then you'd add a gravity contribution and Einstein over the circle.
Well, that's it. So this couples to gravity, but I'm just saying if you vary this with respect to the embedding, I mean just this action, nothing, then you find that equation. It's clear. It's really clear. So okay, I should. Well, maybe there are some further questions, but so Jay will tell you something now about the dynamics that you can read of. I just want to say one last thing here. DBI. I mean, this generalizes, or it's of the DBI form, right? In the sense that the DBI equations are, of course, also just this equation, but the crucial difference is just this, and maybe you have some external forces, but you can also have this in D-brains, but crucial difference in the DBI, your energy momentum tensor is that of the extremal brain. Here your energy momentum tensor is that of the black brain. And it's in that sense that we say this is a new method to look at the generalization of DBI for thermalized objects. But it's of course in the supergravity regime, right? It's in the regime where we have integrated out the open string degrees of freedom and replaced them by gravitational degrees of freedom. So it's sort of in the, you need a large stack of D brains on top of each other. Okay, I'll clean the blackboard for you, then you can start talking meanwhile.
Actually, before you, I guess the pressure is defined, I mean, normally you read up the stress tensor asymptotically, and then you sort of say what the pressure would have been if they were in the location of the blackboard and integrate that in the world
body. Right.
Is that, I'm just verifying that that's
the. So, yeah, you just write here the local pressure.
Okay.
So what I want to say in very, very briefly, maybe in 10 or 15 minutes, is I want to try to convince you that those two equations actually describe the properties of black brain, or maybe that black brains have properties of both of fluids and of solids. And for that, I mean, for knowing what an object really is, you have to do something with it. You cannot just look at it, you have to poke it, deform it, do something with it. So by applying different deformations to the brains, you will know what kind of behavior it has, because so far you can't really say much about it. So I'll just write these two equations here that Niels wrote before. Which are supposed to describe fluid and elastic properties. And what I want to do, since I will have to deform my brain to know how these equations get corrected to next order in some long wavelength approximation, after that deformation is done, you will read the stress energy tensor from those brains, and that will be corrected. So what I want to do in these 10 minutes is just to show what these corrections are. So if I write the energy momentum tensor as an integral over the brain world volume, then to zeroth order, we already know that it's going to be, say, these are world volume indices, of the perfect fluid type plus something here, localized where the object is. Where the brain is. So the first type of perturbation is something that Mukun has mentioned in his talk, which is of hydrodynamic nature. And it's simply by, you just simply take your brain, say a string, wherever. It has some thickness R0,
written the fluid velocities here, the boost velocities here, as a function of the whirl volume. And you allow it to vary with the wavelength such that the thickness is much smaller than one. So you make it wiggle like this, something like this. Now, if you do this in a derivative expansion, you take your brain and you solve Einstein's equations in this derivative expansion, in that parameter, you will find that the equations of motion to zeroth order are these ones, with the stress energy tensor of a perfect fluid, that one. If you go to next order in this parameter, you will find that the energy momentum tensor gets corrected. It gets viscous corrections. The equation of motion is still this one. This one plays no role because you haven't done any extrinsic deformation, so it's zero. And so you acquire two terms here. One is a shear viscosity, sorry, a bulk viscosity, times an expansion of the flow lines, times the pressure tensor, minus the shear viscosity times the shear tensor. Now, the difference between this and the hydrodynamics in ADS CFT is simply that now you have a bulk viscosity. Since the fluid is not conformal, you can actually press it along longitudinal directions, and you can measure this coefficient. So this coefficient actually is just, so if the shear viscosity saturates the normal bound, and the bulk viscosity is also saturates a bound.
Is the calculation which you do to calculate this shear viscosity different from the calculation that?
Not really. It's also just measuring the computing the stress energy tensor at the boundary. Now the boundary, where is it? Is that what you're asking? Or this, you compute the stress energy tensor at infinity. In Schwarzschild coordinates, would be just r equals infinity. And you do this with the Brown-York formalism, and you also have to subtract the background on the surface that you're computing. And in that way, you get the stress energy tensor in that form, and you write it in that way, and you just read off the coefficients.
I'm trying to decide how surprising it is that you get the same answer. Is it something that you could have just foreseen because it's the same calculation, or is it really different calculations which happen to give the same answer?
I don't think it's very surprising. I mean, it's still it's a black brain. It's a fluid living on that thing. So
I think at least the way I see this formula, yeah, it goes back even the absorption cross section of membranes. The whole point is the modes that are sort of that you excite, yeah, for the shear, they are minimally coupled scalars. I mean, they effectively in the background. We don't do the nonlinear problem as Jay described, we do the linear problem. They're just minimally coupled scalars in the black brain background. And we know that their absorption cross section is proportional to the area. And that's all there is to that.
There's a number.
There's a number, but that number was shown to work a long time ago. The absorption cross section is area over whatever.
So you say it's clear that you get the same number because it's.
I mean, this is the proof given in the early days for why eta over s is 1/4 pi
to
very very.
In the original diagram, she was using
Kibler. So that's in the linear S scale. The core formula, yeah. So that's what I'm doing. That's what related to the absorption cross section.
Yes. Okay, so the interesting thing about this, I think, is not really that you can measure these corrections, but that you can predict the instabilities of these brains just by looking at this order. And this was what Mukund has mentioned in his talk. Because if you look at a Gregory Laplan instability of black brains, taking the full nonlinear Einstein's equations and you search for unstable modes, you will find that the brain is unstable. Curves that look like this. So this would be the frequency, and this would be the wave number. And as you go higher in co-dimension, the unstable curve looks like this and has a cutoff there. And if you would just take this equation with that first order corrected stress energy tensor, perturb the density with a certain wavelength and frequency, you would see that the curves you would get would be almost the same. Something like here, in to zero, k wave number is zero, it would be exact, but then it would somehow go a bit off somewhere. But if you would take the co-dimension of the brain very high and in the limit, which is infinite, it would exactly match the curve there. So the interesting thing is that the dynamics of black brains, at least in this regime, seem to be completely captured by the Black-Fold equation to linear order, at least in the high co-dimension limit. So I'm sure everyone is convinced that it has fluid properties. It's not a new thing. The new thing, which I think is more interesting, is the solid properties. So for this, I'll be very pedantic, and I'm sorry if it offends your brilliant minds, but I will take just a piece of wood, and I will bend it with some radius r. Now, if you take a piece of wood or anything, a rod, and you bend it, there's a surface called the neutral surface, which is neither stretched nor compressed, which goes more or less here, something like this. So if I assign a coordinate here, r equals 0, I will see that if you mildly bend it, so it's very thin rod compared to this radius, there will be an induced stress on it, which will be proportional to the strain. It's very mild. Now, the way that this line element here along this direction, say z, varies as I move along the perpendicular direction to the neutral surface is simply, So the new line element along this direction varies like this. This means that the strain in this direction is just this. And if the material is isotropic, then the stress induced is just the Young modulus times the strain. Now, there's some other thing that is known in material science, which is called the bending moment. Because the material is bent, in this inner region, matter is compressed, in the outer region, it's depleted. So here you will have a bigger induced strain, a stress, which goes to zero on the neutral surface, and in opposite directions here. This means that there is a torque or a bending moment along the neutral surface.
So the neutral surface is just the point where the density is the same as
where there is exactly the same as the original material. So it's neither stretched nor compressed. So you can calculate this bending moment simply. I will say that the bending moment zz direction in a transverse direction to the neutral surface is simple, the integral over the cross section of the ring, of the rod here, of the stress along that coordinate. And this is simply y, over r times I. I is the moment of inertia, and it depends only on the geometric properties of the rod. So I is the integral of the cross section of r squared.
You can also
compute the elastic energy, or the elastic free energy, which is the integral of the stress times the strain. And it's a half of y r squared I. Now, if you're a material scientist, you can apply whatever loads you want to your object and measure the deflections, and then you can measure the Young modulus. But imagine that this material is actually really weird, that every time you try to get close to it, it runs away. Or if imagine that you needed an object so big and so massive as Jupiter to bend it. So you wouldn't be able to apply any loads and measure its deflections. But imagine that the material is so weird that you could be sitting somewhere here, really far away from the object, and measure its bending moment with the clock and the rod, or its energy moving along some killing vector field or whatever you want. Then you would see that the material wouldn't really be thick, in the sense that all the thickness of the material will be integrated out and will be characterized by some geometric quantities. If you had some knowledge about those geometric quantities, you could make up what the Young modulus of it was. So what happens for black brains is that these measurements have to be taken like this. So black brains are, from the point of view of material science, really weird materials.
But they have the same properties.
And I'll show you how.
So for in general, the neutral surface is not in the middle of the...
No, you can be really picky about it.
But didn't you assume, didn't you formulate
this? I formulated as if it was exactly in the middle. But it's defined by the equation. But no, you can see really like this exercise is in Feynman's book. You can really see it that it's not right in the middle.
I mean, you can imagine lots of.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, but you can precisely define it by showing that the stress has to be zero compressed. There can be no compression. Whatever.
And so for the black holes, it will turn out that the neutral surface is somewhere for them?
It's actually, I just figured that out recently, so I don't really know where it is. It's parametrized by a certain parameter, but I don't really know how to say if it's in the middle or if it's not in the middle. Yeah. But I know that it's the right surface because there's only change of shape on it and no compression, no stretch. So anyway, if you see how I computed this bending moment, it's the same way as you compute the dipole moment in a charge distribution, right? You would just do the integral over this times a coordinate times something. So in the end, this bending moment is actually a dipole moment. And now, since you're looking at the black brain, there's some mass. Mass gets stretched, gets compressed. That mass is energy. That energy is supposed to be described by an energy momentum tensor. So you have to apply the deformation, the dipole deformation, to an energy momentum tensor. So the way you do this was the first, or at least that I know, that person did this was Pat Papetro, to apply it to a spinning point particle, because it's the same type of deformation you have to do to the stress. So you do this simply by adding a contribution to the stress, which is proportional to a derivative of a delta function. So you expand the energy momentum tensor in a delta function series. So if this is the first order correction times a delta function, then you add another term, which takes one more index, contracted with a derivative of a delta function. And you could add more and more. Now this tensor here, you can decompose it into several parts. If the two first indices are transverse to the whorl volume, you describe spin. And if the two first indices are parallel to the whorl volume, you can describe its bending. So you introduce whorl volume dipoles. So I'm going to ignore the spin, but you can take into account. And it turns out that for black brains, it's just you can see it as a particle current living on the whorl volume. But I won't mention that. So I'll only.
So this you could use to read
Myers-Berry brains. So these components, I will call it like dim u nu rho. And now I'm going to be very blunt, and I'm going to make an analogy that you might not like. But this component here is obtained by integrating g mu nu over space-time dimensions, g mu nu, times a transverse coordinate to the whorl form. In this way, I obtain this. So I'm just claiming that that component, dim u nu rho, in which those indices are parallel to the whorl volume, so I should say AB, for example, is the dipole moment of your stress energy tensor. So if the material, or if the black brain is really to behave elastically, I'm going to make a direct analogy with this here. So the material won't be black brains. You cannot expect it to be isotropic. There's a time component there. It should be anisotropic. So I'm going to say bluntly that dAB rho is a kind of, it's an elasticity tensor. In this case, generalization of the Young modulus. You would find this in crystals, which are anisotropic. Contracted with the extrinsic curvature, which here is just R. You could imagine different things. So you can claim that maybe this is wrong, but we can measure from an analytic exact solution, approximate, and show that at least we can write it in this form. So how do we do this? We use a method, which I'm not sure if you're aware of, called the method of matched asymptotic expansion. So very quickly, if I have some source, some brain here, or some object that I want to construct, there will be a which is characterized by a horizon scale, R0. There will be a region here above which you'll be in the linearized gravity region. You're very far away from the source. The field is weak. You can linearize Einstein's equations and solve it. But if you know that there's some region of the source where the object which you know what the metric is, or you expect it to be locally something, so locally a boosted black membrane, then there's this region here, which is much smaller than R, where you know the metric. So you can construct a solution perturbatively by going to this far region here and solving Einstein's equations with the source, which is the source that you expect your object to have. So if I want to bend the string into a ring, I put the dim u nu of a ring, which is just going to be the perfect fluid one with the right embedding geometry. So I solve it for a correction here, say. I solve for this correction. I get the metric all over here. I can go here then, and I take the boosted black membrane, and I bend it. I apply it a deformation. So if this is the metric of the string, I apply it another deformation. And I solve imposing horizon regularity and this metric as a boundary condition in this region here, I solve for that metric. So you get the completed corrected geometry to the order R0 over R. And this was first done by Niels and Emparan and collaborators for bending just a string into a ring in any dimension. And it was recently generalized by Kamps and Emparan for any arbitrary shape as long as there's no boundaries. So it has no boundaries, the object. And you can actually derive from first principles with this method by imposing, by solving Einstein's equation, you'll see that you get exactly this equation here. So now what we do is, since we have the complete corrected geometry to that order, I'm going to read off what the energy momentum tensor of that corrected geometry is. And I will find that I can, I wrote it down here, but sorry. I will find that this piece here, which is going to be still the perfect fluid stress tensor, and I will find this beaming new rho, which is only this component thing, and I will find it that I can write exactly in this form. And for a ring bent over a circle, I can just write it here. You'll have four different components. Where P is the pressure, times and the function of gamma functions, and another one.
Is Y totally symmetric in all four of these things?
No, it's bisymmetric.
It's bisymmetric.
Yeah, it's the exact same symmetries that you expect in an elasticity tensor. So then you'll find here something very similar. Like this. So maybe you can disagree on the interpretation, but you have some response coefficient there for a brain which has been bent, whatever it is. But now I can make the intuition that it's elastic much more precise, or at least a little bit. And that is simply because if I have the object here and I want to measure distances along any of these surfaces, I will measure that thing with gamma B. So gamma B will describe the state of strain of whatever surface I have, because I measure distances with that. I want to know how gamma B changes along transverse directions. So that is simply the lead derivative along a certain normal vector of gamma B. And that is KAB rho contracted with that transverse direction. So along any transverse direction, the strain varies proportional to this. And this is, in fact, you can define it as a strain tensor along a certain direction. So what you find here in this form, simply, by writing is that the dipole or the elastic correction is proportional to the strain. Now, more convincing is that you can see how these equations are modified. And you do that simply by plugging in your stress energy tensor expended in that in a delta function series. And you will find that the equations do not change. What does change is TAB. TAB is now the TAB of a perfect fluid plus a sigma B. And this sigma B is now dAB rho contracted with K rho, the extrinsic mean curvature vector. And if I plug in here what ABCD is, or what dAB rho is, I find that it's the elasticity tensor contracted with the strain tensor.
Or in other words,
the stress is proportional to the strain. And this is exactly what you expect from a Hookean regime when you bend mildly some object. So you can even make this more precise, and it hasn't been done yet, it hasn't been published yet, but you can really show that the extrinsic dynamics and all the thermodynamic behavior along these transverse directions behave exactly like the thermodynamics of an elastic solid. So it's more than convincing that it's a solid.
So if you take a string and you bend it, first of all, the area of the horizon is constant in that process?
It won't change.
It will not change.
The first order, no.
And the mass, I guess, density is also constant.
Yes.
So you say that this indicates that it will want to spring back sort of in some adiabatic-like process.
Yeah.
If you bend it, that's proportional to this.
Yeah.
So, well, that surprises the coefficients of the right positivity properties.
Yes.
So do you find cases where they don't?
Well, it's, yeah, I mean.
They have only been computed so far for unusual, like, frames. We're trying to also to compute these and actually yet other new response coefficients for charged frames.
Yeah, I should mention
that you also have new responses.
Yeah, I should mention, because if you now imagine that the thing is charged and you bend it, you get a really electric dipole moment on it because all the material is charged. But it's not a dipole moment in the sense of a dielectric because you haven't put it into a background field. It's a dipole moment in the sense of a piezoelectric because the dipole moment is induced by the mechanical stress. So you will compute structure constants which are piezoelectric structure constants. But then you can imagine putting it, saying, in EDS CFD, in EDS 5 cross S5 with the background gauge field. And now you will also have a dielectric behavior, and you'll be able to compute magnetic and electric susceptibilities.
For the uncharged string, I find it a bit. Some bit of a counterintuitive, because once you start bending it, you might imagine that the sides of it want to collapse together. So after some point, they will want to bend.
Well, it's also that for these solutions, they're stationary. So we're imposing stationary on it. We really choose the tension such that it maintains.
Right, but the response properties are read off from.
Yeah.
I see what you said. At some point it wants to crack. To this order we don't see that.
I cannot do that to this order, I think. I mean, if it cracks, then it's not elastic anymore. I mean, it's like plastic. So it's really like going off the Hookean regime, right? I mean, you have stress proportional to strain, and all of a sudden there's.
So I'm getting a very strange picture here. So I'm supposed to think of a black fold as sort of like a hollow container filled with fluid, so that the internal dynamics are fluid-like, but the bending is solid.
You should think of the fluid moving on the surface of something. So it's not inside a material, but the surface. So if I would have the fluid moving on some thin, very thin film, and then I would be able to bend that film, then if the fluid was real, you would be able to see the solid properties.
Since it's not dynamic, how can you tell it's a fluid? It's just a distribution of stress and energy on the surface.
No, but the internal dynamics is just fluid dynamics.
You know, well, no, he's got no internal dynamics. He's considering stationary situations.
Half the equations look like fluid dynamics of some internal degrees of freedom, and half the equations look like this elastic solid But the black brain really has, I mean, some thicknesses are not, which you're not really probing in this approximation, I know.
Well, it's there. Otherwise, the dipole, the bending moment wouldn't be there.
But you're saying it's more of, why isn't it inside the container? Why is it on top of the container rather than inside the container?
It must be localized in some surface.
Because really you don't see any thickness.
Yes, right. Yes.
You should think it like that.
Yeah.
Like a sheet that hovers in space time, and it's.
And then you.
It's infinitely thin, spread out over the surface.
It's just a generalization to the thin membrane theory in elasticity. You've got a textbook and you get the conservation equations within the surface, and then you get the extrinsic equations. So if you want to calculate the shape of a dome, that's exactly the equations we use.
But the intrinsic equations of an actual membrane look like the same.
Well, just TRJ, semicolon J equals zero. Levels. Because it's non-covariant for the ordinary world, those incorporate the elasticity rules. It's conservation of stress, otherwise it would start moving. If there's a force, you put the force on the right-hand side. And now, because the thing's embedded in three dimensions, you made a formula which tells you how the force on a gun in the orthogonal direction is causing stresses in the shell itself. So you take the trace of the energy momentum transform in the shell, and you do that, the pressure of the vertical force, the unit area. Those describe membranes. Those are the things the engineers use every day. But you see, you don't have to assume in this formalism that it's fluid. The engineers certainly wouldn't make a dome out of the fluid.
What you're saying is that for these kind of elastic solids, you have some internal stress energy, and that responds to the external forces, the bending in particular.
Well, there's internal and external.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's take the classic case of the dome, which is very interesting. There you assume a sphere, for example, and you look at the stresses. The external forces of gravity, and you need to know how the stresses vary as you go around the dome. And you will find, actually, if you start like this, because the stresses or the tensions become, if it's a masonry dome, then it can only take compression. So if you solve the equations and find that the compressive force is going negative, you're in trouble, and that's why you can never build a dome bigger than a certain radius, a certain angle is prescribed angle equal to the tank. You always have to have a hole, otherwise the domes crack. And the equations are identical to these equations, except they've only got an you've got a stress tensor localized thin membrane. Which has to satisfy the usual conservation law that compared to the applied force tangentially. And then the trace of the energy momentum tends is equal to the component of the force normally. That gives you everything. Now, if you have an isotropic thing, that's just the theory of soap bubbles.
Sure.
That's important. So, this is what this production is, and this is what you have to describe.
That is the covariant process, and then applied to very specific stuff, namely like brands.
But then it would be possible, but you apparently haven't got examples that your Young's marginal.
Indeed,
that would be negative, so you bent it, you're going to bend more. You haven't found it, that's what you're saying.
But is there some understanding of that, like any sort of intricate level?
Why they behave like solids?
I mean, why does it
go? Why doesn't one go? But she mentioned that, so she doesn't look at the leading or equation, and then by perturbing that, you can get the speed of elastic waves, which is. That speed is, that speed squared is positive, so it's stable under elastic perturbations, basically because the pressure is negative, i.e. there's tension. I'm not entirely sure if you should look at it, but this correction, I mean, this would change that speed.
Maybe, oh, I see, so if you think of that, would it do to just say the horizon has some tension and that thing comes to straighten
That's a little bit my intuition. So,
if your original thing is stable, doesn't at this order doesn't y have to be positive? Otherwise, wouldn't you have a problem right away?
No, because this would be a correction.
Oh,
you have to consider this would correct the leading order speed of the. Things that have positive tension, this is some positive number. But this would correct this. Okay, then you could say that correction could be have been positive or negative. It seems we haven't done the algebra.
But with this formula, it's clear that if you have objects which have pressure and not tension, transfer speed or something.
Right.
Like brains, your black brains have tension, not pressure.
Right. Which means. That's right. That's so if you had so all normal brains have tension. But maybe somebody
go to the opposite end, go to ADS brains.
Yeah.
It could be there they could.
So the picture is probably the opposite.
Because they have tension, you have the real Lambster. Intrinsic dynamics, fluid more than stable.
Right.
But the pressure, the bending.
That's right. And I'm not going to say anything, because the speed of sound is.
Yes.
So there's. Typically, if this is negative, that's positive, and vice versa. And for ADS brains, it's more or less the opposite. Because they're impossible to pressure.
Do you know what happens if you couple this to some non uniformity on the word wall? Does that influence this?
If you did the intrinsic perturbation simultaneously.
Yeah,
if you have like.
Would a wiggly string be more, want to jump back to straight string more than.
At least at the linear order, if you assume some separation of scales, I don't think you see anything. But maybe when they start coupling.
This is resulted like this plus this plus this plus.
Oh, I forgot to add here.
Yeah, plus. Plus that's correct to first order, basically because they decouple the first order and derivatives, the interest x-ray. That's interesting. Well, there are many interesting problems, but the whole computation anyway of next order transport coefficients, which we know some people are doing, is interesting. But and then the dynamics was going to couple. Booker, do you still like to say something about this sort of story where you ended, or you think we have sort of
maybe we have nothing to say about the extrinsic story. because I haven't given the deck or any detail. But for the engineering dynamics, for the fluid dynamics, it's what I was saying, what you described. You can study the dynamics of any surface, not necessarily at infinity. And the details change, the transport coefficients. Some of them change, some of them don't. But thermodynamics will change because so two different quantities of heat. Effective fluid looks different when you look at it on pure regimes. The picture you drew is probably a very simple way to sort of see the various interpolating between this general picture, something we understand in areas for conformal fluids, and something we would like to understand for inconformal fluids.
Well, that's great.
So, yeah. Thank you.